This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The year is 1990, and Thomas Wolfe's novel about stockbrokers, socialites, civil servants, and journalists of the 1980s in New York City was being adapted into the most anticipated film of the decade. The film was to be helmed by a director who essentially molded the cinematic excess of the 1980s, and it was to star two of the biggest box office draws in roles that many believed would either make or break their careers. But at the end of the day, the film went down in history as not only being one of the biggest box office bombs of the decade, but the most disappointing film adaptation of all time, garnishing hate from critics to theatergoers for decades to come. Has time been kind to this film? A film whose expose book entitled The Devil's Candy went on to be just as salacious as the novel that the film was based on. Tonight, we cover Brian De Palma's infamous Bonfire of the Vanities. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult-Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Huge, huge Brian De Palma fan. And in my early teens, maybe even earlier than that, I started watching every Brian De Palma film I could get my hands on at the Blockbuster or the Good Time Video or the library. And there were a few that were like really hard to get that only recently had good releases, you know, as of like the last 5 years. But this was the one film in my early teens and 20s that I just didn't get. I remember the novel was huge. My parents had it. I remember it being on their shelf or being in the bathroom. Like, it was a novel that everybody was reading of that generation, right? And then I just remembered it being like notoriously hated and a box office bomb. So since that early viewing in my teens, never watched it again. Yet I champion like literally every other film the dude has made. So I put it on the list because it is for me like the lost De Palma film, but also, why was it hated so much? Why did the critics hate it? Why did the people who loved the book hate it so much? And we're going to get into that tonight. So before I even remark on how I feel about this movie, what do you got?
So this is one, and I'm with you. I love Brian De Palma. All of his movies I've sought out except for this one.
Yeah.
I didn't even see this one until I think it was when my daughter was born in my late 20s, where I was holding her, it came on TV, and I couldn't change the channel, so I just watched it because I haven't watched it before. And I got to say, I wasn't disappointed I didn't seek it out earlier because I wasn't impressed. And this one was a great opportunity for a second watch to see full attention. Let me see on a critique wise how this movie was. And I hated it even more the second time around. So I can absolutely see the hate, or I should say the distaste for this movie, especially I've never read the novel. Neither. This is one of those that was always on my to-do list and I've never read it. And this one actually steers me away from reading it, but gives me a little bit of curiosity because you can tell there are so many elements missing from this screenplay that it was almost frustrating watching it the second time.
Okay. This is going to be a fun conversation because guess what? I fucking loved it.
Oh, no.
But not for the reasons, and because you know me by now. We're on episode like 30-something. If you don't know me by now, I have reasons for liking things that most people hate. This movie feels like the perfect movie made up of all the wrong pieces. That's why I loved it. I think Brian De Palma had the perfect vision for what it was supposed to be visually. Aesthetically, I think that he nailed it 100%. But everybody in this movie is wrong. The cast is wrong. The script feels like it should be right, but it feels wrong being delivered by the people in charge. So it made me really kind of just dig into it. I watched it 3 times, man. And each time I liked it more and more and more because of how it challenges me. So I'm going to kind of just bullet point it right now. Number one, original director for this, Mike Nichols. Perfect choice. On paper, perfect choice. You're making a satire about socialites of New York City, about stockbrokers, about the racial injustices, but also the bullshit behind the political movement of the time of we really need to cater to the minority group to stay in office. Something we still deal with today, except this painted like a satirical picture on it. It feels like something that Mike Nichols should have made. When Mike Nichols had it under his control, Steve Martin was supposed to play the Tom Hanks role. Perfect. That would have been perfect. But we all know how movies go. People can't agree on a script. People can't agree on a budget. People can't agree on a star. And so it got shifted to De Palma. Comedy, you know? The other person that I think could have done this, because it feels very similar to that, is Jonathan Demme. It feels like it could have been a Jonathan Demme project. It's got courtroom scenes. It's got like awkward romantic moments and tension. And visually, it's quirky enough that I think Demme could have done it. It kind of does feel like Married to the Mob in certain ways. So I love the De Palma aspect of this, but Tom Hanks, wrong guy. Melanie Griffith, wrong woman. Bruce Willis, what the fuck? But that 4-minute and 30-second opening one shot of him pulling up to the limo, going down through the bowels of the World Trade Center, going into the service elevator, that to me was the most impressive one shot I've seen in decades. I like it better than the infamous Copacabana one shot in Goodfellas. I was entranced by it. Yeah, we have Bruce Willis mugging in just the most awkward Bruce Willis way, but it didn't bother me because technically the movie just floored me. So at the end of the day, does it deserve the hate it gets? 100%. 100% it does. But there are wackos like me that actually love watching the train wreck. And now I can't wait to read that book, The Devil's Candy, about the making of it and all the salacious stories behind it, because I bet it just makes it even better. So this had to have been one of my most favorite rediscoveries of a long, long time because of how much it excited me. Because it's crazy. It's a train wreck. And I loved it.
You see, that's what I always appreciate about you is you don't steer away from loving the hate of a movie. So, and I love that you're honest about it. So to me, it's hard to follow up to you since you just admitted I wanted to argue about this movie so bad and you just went ahead and just filled in the blanks for me. But here's the deal is I think De Palma was... There's two missing elements missing from this. The script is horrible and the tone is off. Palma is notorious for that darker tone, that serious tone, and he doesn't really change much. So the script is already horrible to the extent that it's missing elements. But at the end of the day, it's up to the director to pivot to execute the vision. And here, he doesn't change much, which is hard for me to say for Palma because I love him so much, but he still gives that dark tone. And we start to question about during the second act, what kind of movie this is trying to be. Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Is it a romance? Is it all of them? We don't really know, even though this one's categorized as all three. But never do I laugh. Never do I, am I sure if I'm supposed to laugh? And then right from the minute, the only time I laugh during that first act is when Tom Hanks comes down with that god-awful rich accent that he decides to lose halfway through the movie.
And right?
It drove me nuts that I was talking back to my screen last night. So this to me is a direction problem because all of these elements are missed. It's the wrong tone for the writing that's being delivered. Either rewrite the damn script or change the tone because the tone to me it could work because it is that taboo. It's that edgy, that, like you said, the devil's candy kind of topic. We're talking about these taboo rich people that just put a kid in coma. So this does deserve a dark element, but the script required rewriting or for Palma to pivot on his direction, because this movie has no flipping clue what it wants to do. And I will give you this. It does have some great shots in it. If it was a better movie, I would appreciate it more, because we can cherry pick a lot of these great shots out of these scenes, but it's just disappointing that they don't do anything with it. But I will say this in defense to Bruce Willis is, I didn't have a problem with Bruce Willis. He's the only one I didn't. What I had a problem with is that he was completely underplayed and underdeveloped. We don't do much with this character that has his potential. Even I can tell that he has a big piece of the book that's not even scratched the surface in this movie. I think he could have done an outstanding job if he had more to work with, because we see him pop up here and there, and we kind of get him driving the story to an extent, but there's no edge, there's no depth to it. And that's the holistic message of this movie, is that it lacks any kind of edge. Until we get the dirty-talking Melanie Griffith on screen, and that's the only edge we have to it. This movie needed to be more taboo, it needed to have more edge to it, and more bite. All this is us following Tom Hanks around, just wandering around screen for 2 hours, and it was just not interesting, and I didn't care for the least.
How crazy is this? I did not want to spoil myself from reading too much about the background production, because I want to read that book, and I want to know more about the production, but apparently the characters are totally different. Like, essentially, Tom Hanks' role was very much like what Steve Martin would have played it, so that could have been the perfect thing. The socialite, you know, Maria, the Melanie Griffith character, she's supposed to be a lot more a Southern charm and less kind of like Southern floozy, right? An interesting choice for Melanie Griffith to play it that way. And then the Bruce Willis character, Fallow, he's supposed to be like a smarmy British journalist. I feel like he was almost supposed to be like the Robert Downey Jr. character in Natural Born Killers, you know, just a very snivelly, conniving type of, you know, he's Australian in that movie, but like anything to get the story, any way to manipulate the story to make him more popular, more famous. And Bruce Willis doesn't really play it that way. Instead, halfway through the movie, he starts playing with like an empathy towards the people that he's writing about, which I agree with you. It doesn't feel right because it doesn't match the way we're introduced to him at the beginning or at the end. They try and patch it up with like his closing narration. He's like, here I was writing about these socialites and now I'm one of them. It's not enough, but it does attempt to try and justify, of course, satirically, because this is a satire, his journey and how he has now been transformed into everything that he was writing about that's bad. So yeah, the characters don't work at all. But then I read that Bruce Willis and Tom Hanks were so defended by the studio that any choices that they made, De Palma didn't have a lot of control over what the studio wanted. He wanted them darker, and the studio was like, well, if they're too dark, then people aren't going to like them, and they're big bankable stars. We want people to like them. So they made the characters likable, but in the book, they're not supposed to be. So you're right. It throws the whole rhythm of what the story is supposed to be completely off. And this is where I take my hat off to De Palma. Essentially, he's like, well, if I don't get to direct these actors and make these characters the way I feel they should be, then I'm going to make this the most De Palma-looking movie you've ever fucking seen. And I'm going to take every little trick in my toolbox and I'm going to put it in a movie that it doesn't belong in. Loved it. We've got the Carrie split screen. We've got multiple examples of split diopter. Every cinematic trick that De Palma has used in every one of his films is in this movie. And they shouldn't be. But they are, because he's like, fuck it. I can't do anything about these performances. So I'm just going to make the most De Palma movie I've ever made. And whatever happens, happens. And here's the thing. He likes this movie. He's like, come out and said, he's like, I don't get why people hate it so much. And, you know, if they do, it's fine. I like what I did under the circumstances that I had, which made me like it even more. Because essentially, that's just him saying, all right, you hired me to direct a movie. I'm going to direct a Brian De Palma movie, regardless of what you want it to be at the end of the day. Let these assholes with their big paychecks, because it was the biggest paycheck that Bruce Willis, Tom Hanks, and Melanie Griffith had in their entire careers up to that point. They got paid so much money compared to the budget that they had all the shots. They controlled the set. Melanie Griffith, during like a little break in production, got breast implants. So her chest size fluctuates throughout the movie, and De Palma's just like, fuck it.
Now I have to do another rewatch. I miss that completely. So, all right, that gave me a reason. Well, I get it. So if the studios have control, I get that. But here's kind of the thing on the double-edged sword of that. The ego of directors, I love it. I love the sticking to the creative guns, but at the end of the day, there are more at stake when it comes to the vision of art, the entertainment value, and the actors that play under his direction. He's the captain right. of the ship. So at this point, he can give his vision of it, but there is a movie in here that would work. But I think if we were to pivot and actually say, you know what, I'm going to allow these actors to kind of improvise a little bit. I'm going to have them insert some more dialogue, because to me, the overlaying message after watching this movie is that it's missing so much. Every 5 minutes, I felt like it was missing something. And then we don't get that overlaying feeling until we get to the last 10, 15 minutes that really pissed me off of this courtroom scene. That's just ludicrous. Put a bow. You have the judge accepting evidence. You have him give him a motivational speech. You have Bruce Willis narrating what Tom Hanks is about to do. It is so stupid that I made me hate the rest of the movie 10 times more than if I didn't see the ending. So it was one of the most frustrating climaxes I have ever seen. And it was painful watching Morgan Freeman give such a great performance and a great courtroom speech in such a horrible designed scene.
It's like these million-dollar abstract paintings that people just stare at and pay all this money for. But I would look at it and be like, I don't understand this. But this is that version for me. I will stare at it and I'll understand it because I can see all the things going on behind it. So the girl that wrote The Devil's Candy, her name's Julie Salomon. And he actually hired her to document the filmmaking process because he thought they were making like the biggest hit in the world. Think about the pressure. This was the most popular book of the 1980s. And you're the guy that's going to adapt it into a movie. You are like the number one person I know who is critical about novel to cinema adaptations. Pretty much every week or every month, at least on your show, there is an adaptation that you have to review. And your biggest criticism is that leap from page to screen and what sacrifices were made or what was added, what was taken away. And does it really feel like this is a real adaptation, or is this something that is just we're taking the name, we're taking the popularity, and then we're doing our own thing cinematically, hoping that people will just pay their ticket because it's called what it is based off the best-selling novel. This is that, but it's the biggest example of that, of the 80s. But here's also the thing, is like 1990, 91, people were already done with the excess of the 80s, right? So maybe it was just a little too late. The nostalgia and admiration for this novel had an expectation set so high that eventually, like, it seemed like everything was just crumbling under the pressure. And instead of asking the person he brought to document this filmmaking experience, he told her to go harder. He's like, don't censor anything. This is psycho. This is going to make a great book. And at the end of the day, her expose on this movie was a bigger seller and a bigger hit than the movie adaptation of this book was. And that just goes to show, man, like, people almost wanted this to fail. Like, it was so big that it couldn't be good. There was no chance it could be good. It was the perfect epitome of that 80s into 90s mentality where everything was built up so big and there's so much excess that the final result is a total disaster. It's like the housing market collapsing, right? It's too big to break. Oh, no, it's not. It's going to break, and it's going to break hard. $50 million budget, and it only made 15 at the box office.
It almost reminds me of when E.L. James released the 50 Shades of Grey adaptation, yeah, where people had, yeah, such high expectations, and it just, it did well, but at the same time, it was a horrible movie. But here, this one, kind of like 50 Shades, I did read the 50 Shades, but all of these movies I call Cliff Notes adaptions, yeah, because they, yeah, yeah, just, yeah, hit plot points, and they don't put anything in between. So to me, this one made me so angry. I can see why wanting to see this movie fail, I would be in that group if I watched this when it came out because of how sloppy it was, even if I didn't read the book, because it almost was an insult to me that I'm sitting through this and there's no effort to kind of fill in the blanks with these characters. There's no effort to really tell me about these characters. It's just literally structured, segmented, just plot points put onto a screen with no attention to detail. And the performances support exactly what's on the page because they don't even have enough to deal with. So to me, this adaption is, Vampires was one of my worst adaptions. I'm going to take it back. I haven't even read the book. This is probably going to be the worst adaption because at 700 pages, you know there's some detail in that book. And here's what I would say to the challenge of that time is it wasn't extremely popular to do a chapter one, chapter two, like we have today to milk the studio, milk the movie's money. But this one at 700 pages almost screamed a two-parter because there is no way you can squeeze in a two-hour movie, 700 pages or even half of that into it and give a proper interpretation.
Right. It should have been like a mini series, right? It should have been, yeah, something that they could have taken their time. I mean, they already did it with the Stephen King movies, right? Make these four-hour, five-hour miniseries. And yes, television does limit you in what you can talk about when it terms of sexuality and vulgarity and like the racial stereotypes and things like that. But I think at the end of the day, we have to remember that this is a satire, and it almost feels like the production of it was a satire as well, right? Like it was just the amount of irony displayed in the stories behind the production and then how this film was actually received compared to the novel it was based on. And when we get to our critics' review, there's a lot of interesting things to be said because they both brought up a very interesting point. But we also have to remember that Roger's written review of this film wasn't that terrible. He gave it a 2.5. I've seen some of the movies that you've given a 2.5 to on your show, and I was just like, eh, interesting. Again, subjective. But we're going to save that other conversation. I think that there are amazing performances in this movie from everyone but the leads. The leads, honestly, to me, give or take, they're the ones that are supposed to carry the story. It was the side characters that kept me invested. So first of all, the queen of this film is Kim Cattrall. She only has 3 scenes in this movie as his wife. Her monologue explaining what her dad does in the stock market was one of my favorite performances of the 80s and 90s. I like Kim Cattrall and a lot of stuff, but she's always Kim Cattrall. But in this, I was like, oh my God, she's playing this socialite, nervous, neurotic wife who hates her husband and everything he does and belittling him in front of her daughter, in front of his parents, to me was like the most perfect moment of this movie. Every time she came on screen, I was so excited. It really made the movie for me. Saul Rubinek, he plays exactly the way that character should be. Neurotic Jewish lawyer. And, you know, he really brings that energy of he's nervous at first because it's his first big case. But by the end, he's got balls. I loved that transition. Kevin Dunn, Clifton James showing up, Alan King showing up, Donald Moffat, one of my favorites, The Thing, as Tom Hanks' dad. Like, the cast is stacked, and everyone's doing such a great job that every time Melanie, Tom, or Bruce showed up, I was just like, bring me back to the fun people. But again, that really made me excited because it's like something to look forward to in a movie that there's not a lot to look forward to.
You hit it on the head because I felt the same way about the supporting characters. That's the only thing that really kept me engaged is look who just showed up. Look who that is. Awesome.
It's F. Murray Abraham as the district attorney.
It's like there's not one supporting cast member that I wasn't surprised to see that I didn't know was in this movie because I didn't care to research it. So it was a pleasant surprise seeing this cast. And to me, that was the one thing keeping me going through this movie is who's going to show up next. And you're right. There are fantastic performances. To me, again, I'll stick to my argument that I don't think that they're horrible performances, with the exception of Tom Hanks. That is his worst performance to date.
Oh, so bad.
Horrible. But I think everybody else had just horrible dialogue that was just underplayed. So I think Tom Hanks, honestly, I cannot stand him in this movie. And I am surprised this didn't derail his career with his performance in this one.
I mean, right. He got to follow it up with, speak of the devil, Jonathan Demme in Philadelphia, which got him the Oscar. So, you know, you get lucky sometimes, you know.
Everybody gets one.
Everybody gets one. Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. All right, so let's go ahead and listen to our critics' take on this film, because they're both in agreement. They're in agreement with pretty much everyone in the critical world of the time. Some opinions have changed over the years. You know, I can't say that mine has, because I saw it when I was just too young to understand what it was. But let's go ahead and listen to what they had to say about it.
The Bonfire of the Vanities, based on Tom Wolfe's fabulous book about New York City in the 80s, with its stock exchange wheeler dealers, their high life society, and the fear and loathing with which they regard the black and Hispanic underclass. The book is full of wit and bile. The movie is full of something else. Director Brian De Palma soft pedals the whole story and has made a very bad film here. I'm very disappointed. Well, all the subject material is intact from the book, but the attitude of contempt is missing. This is more of a lighthearted romp, and I wasn't laughing, not at all. A namby-pamby ending with the judge there, Morgan Freeman, sermonizing is one of the worst of many bad scenes.
So what do you think about that?
I think his verbiage is kind of contradicting in itself, but I think he's on the money when it comes to it, because when it comes to peddling through scenes, I wouldn't even call it peddling, because it feels so segmented. So it's not that they're struggling to peddle to the next scene, it's that they have no idea how they're going to do the next scene based on the material that they just set themselves up for. So I think just to hit bottom with Gene, I think he nailed it. I think the verbiage is wrong, but I think he kind of summarized it pretty well.
I think that the true context of his words speaks to exactly what I was saying when I was defending this movie, where he really says that there's a lot more that we're not getting, and it's kind of a namby-pamby film, and when it's not missing the vileness of the book. Instead, it feels like nothing and almost kind of fluffy. That to me sounds like studio interference. These characters are too dark. I can't believe they did that. Apparently in the book, they do some really vile things to cover up their crimes and to cover up all of the things that are going on politically. Like the Reverend character is a lot more devious than he is in the movie. And he's pretty devious in the movie. So that to me shows that the studio's like, nah, cut that part out. Cut that part out. It's like when I went back and read a bunch of the John Grisham novels after they made all those adaptations in the 90s, and I was like, holy shit, there's some dark stuff in here. they didn't put that in the movie? Well, no, because it's not going to be as likable or as emotionally gripping as the films are, because some of those people do some terrible things. I feel that this is the same thing. There's a lot of terrible things in the book, which now I can't wait to read it. But you can tell the studio fluffed it over because they were so afraid. And this is the exact era we're talking about, man. We're in the blockbuster era, like the 80s to mid 90s. We haven't hit Reservoir Dog time yet. We haven't hit Scorsese's Casino or Goodfellas yet, where we can actually revel in the depravity of these things that people are doing, right? We're still trying to give these dark stories happy endings. It fits with the time that a studio would do this. So as he's explaining all the things that have been truncated or omitted from the book, he is actually, and I think not 100% consciously, telling the story of why the film is the way it is, because the studio didn't want it to be like the book.
Yeah, and we've talked about it. It's not like the book because it's, like you said, mamby-pamby. I love that verbiage, but...
I do, actually, this, too.
It's a fun word. But it tries to be a comedy, but it has no direction to be a comedy. It tries to be satire, but it doesn't have the messaging lined up to actually prove a point of satire. Yeah. So this is where it's going in the fork of the road, where it just really doesn't know where to go. And it goes to kind of what Gene was saying, to one of the horrible scenes that we spoke to earlier, the courtroom scene, that tries to sum it up like a Disney movie with this motivational speech that really just goes nowhere. It becomes comical when it's not supposed to be comical, because you can tell, based on Siskel's take on a lot of these characters, is that there should have been more. We take the Reverend character that comes across more like a cartoon than serious. He comes across as just like a written diabolical villain, and you can tell that's not how he's written. There is some intent to him that we're just not covering. So I think in a summarized version that Siskel is saying, I agree with.
Yeah, it's muted cynicism. The cynicism has been diluted to the point where now these jokes don't land. The point of these characters doing what they do don't land, and you are left with scenes that feel unfinished. Perfect example is a scene where Tom Hanks is wearing the wire to try and get, you know, a taped confession from Melanie Griffith, and instead she kind of like starts seducing him, and then they're interrupted by the lawyer, and then they just run away. We don't get a closure to that. That's the whole movie. It's like three-fourths of a scene that just doesn't know how to finish because it was diluted at some point, or maybe they did shoot it and it just didn't get edited into the movie because who knows what the hell was going on, right? That's why I said, I gotta read that book. I gotta know. I'm so fascinated by it. Anyway, he continues.
I didn't even want to see this. I love this book so much, I didn't want to see the film made, and boy, I sure didn't want to see it made this way.
Well, you know, one of the problems we both have is that we've read the book.
Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine what this movie would seem like to somebody who hadn't read the book. Maybe they'd like it more. The problem is that time after time, the book made such an impression on me that I was sitting there saying to the screen, you know, that's not who that person is. That's not why they're doing that. That's not really right. What happened. That's not what it was like.
Right.
Until what you get is sort of like kind of cartoony highlights of events in the movie, with the movie giving you no idea at all as to why these things are happening or the motivations of the people involved.
Or why it's so important to document what was going on in New York at this time with these people.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no urgency here.
So this is the way I'm going to compare my feelings of this movie to probably your feelings of this movie, right? We are two young kids watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right, for the first time. And you are covering your eyes during the scary scenes because you don't want to be scared. And I'm the one who is watching, not blinking, waiting for the next moment of gore, but then the gore doesn't happen because it's really not that kind of a movie. It's building the tension. It's there. The scares are there. But the promise of limbs flying and viscera all over the place aren't fully delivered. But I'm excited by the idea of it. I think that's what we're talking about here. And it perfectly goes with what he's saying. Everyone read the book in the 80s and the 90s. So they had an expectation of what they wanted the movie to be. But me, having never read the book, not really knowing what it was about, only just vague memories of when I saw it when I was younger, seeing it this time, not knowing everything that I'm supposed to know about these characters, left me with the, well, what happens next? Or where is the aftermath of this, you know, devious story of these people? And there's really no aftermath. We don't even see what happens to Melanie Griffith's character for perjury. We don't see it. It is like such, it's like edging. Like we don't get the full satisfaction of all the things that the movie promises us. And I'm the weird kind of psycho that gets off on that because I was like, oh, they almost got me there. I want more. I want to know more about this book and I want to know more about this production. That's where I am totally enthralled by this film. And his statement about that is like, hey, we read the book. So that's almost like a disservice to us. People who haven't read the book, I wonder what the hell they're going to think about this.
Well, I can tell him what I'll think. I think it was an awful movie because I haven't read the book. And instead of he makes a point, as all we do, as all of us do when we read the book and then see the movie, is that's not how this character is written. That's not what happens here. So I get that for the people seeing that movie and they might be upset. But instead, for people that didn't see the movie, I was saying, what in the actual fuck? So there is nothing in between. So basing it, and I am guilty as charged of this, and I did it with the vampires episode, is banking so much on my critique of the book versus the movie. And mm-hmm. here you can tell these two are very passionate about a fan base of the book and what they wanted translated to screen. And what we ended up with is a result that satisfies none of the parties, because there is not enough when it comes to the fan base that I can just hear from multiple critic reviews and multiple fan reviews. And there's nothing for somebody just being introduced to it. So I would be curious about the book, because at this point, would I have a greater appreciation seeing the actual film version first versus the actual novel? I don't know. But I think here, I think he is spending way too much time just looking at it as a pure movie, and that's where we're missing a lot of these elements of what is your critique of the movie, not the adaption. So you can put tidbits of the adaption on why it's not going to satisfy the fans, but how is it as a movie? Because I can tell you right now, looking through my eyes, it sucks.
So I'm so glad you said that, because it leads me into my thought here, and it's a question for you. It's going to take us a little off track. We'll come back. You know, we'll come back to the Shire in a minute, man. At what point do you think, I mean, this will be different for different people and their viewing habits. But for me, there is a point where if I'm watching a film and I start to recognize that the film is no longer a narrative movie that I can follow and that I can be entertained by or enjoy what the film is actually trying to tell me, it starts becoming less of a film and more of an experience, right? I'm no longer looking at this as a movie. I'm no longer looking at this as a first, second, and third act narrative. I'm looking at this as a zoo exhibit. I'm looking at this as something that is doing something to me visually and auditory, and it's no longer a movie. It's become an experience, and now I'm invested in the experience. Not everyone watches movies that way, but for some reason, I just have this thing where I can tell that if I continue my expectation of watching a movie as a movie, I'm doing myself a disservice and will not let myself feel justified that I spent 2 hours and 10 minutes of my time watching something. It's almost like you have to adjust. You have to redirect your energy into, well, this isn't a movie anymore. This is an exhibition. And that's how I felt about this. And there's lots of movies that David Lynch movies, I think, are an example of that. You know, not a lot of them are very strong narratively. So you take yourself out of that narrative mindset and you put yourself in the immersive experience of what it is visually, what the score is doing, what the editing's doing, if there's a fucking strobe light making like you seizure. And that, I think, is the best way to describe my attachment to this movie. It's not entertaining, and it's not a good movie. It was an experience, and that's the best way that I can justify my personal scoring of this movie and, you know, what it says about me as a cinema appreciator.
Yeah, and with any movie, you want to kind of find things that you want to cherry pick and like and appreciate. It's, and again, some people are going to have different eyes. Like, to your point, people are going to like this movie. And when it gets to that point, with me at least, I try and find something. I know I brought up the musical compositions, the editing, whatever it may be. And when it comes to the experience with this one, I will give it the experience. I was actually talking, like I said, back to the screen on what the hell Tom Hanks was doing with his career at this point. But at the same time, there's a fine line between when you end up in an experience purgatory of watching a movie, and that is where we find just pure intent of laziness or studio constraint. Mm-hmm. Here, I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest with you, where we see the lack of care put into kind of the written dialogue. That's with me. I'm a dialogue guy. You know this, where I just kind of shut down because there's not enough context. And this is the origin of the filmmaking process, is what's written down. If we can't nail that right, that's going to ruin the experience. And there's nothing in the background that's going to really help it if the cast and the director aren't bought into what's written on paper. To me, I gave you the point earlier that it does have a couple great shots. That's what I cherry picked out of it. But holistically, the experience, it wasn't an experience for me. It was a chore to watch this, because if it wasn't for that last 15 minutes, or if that was redirected to kind of flow and give me a satisfactory climax, I could cherry pick a lot more good things. But the fact it led up to just that, just put the exclamation mark on it saying, this is not a pure creative vehicle. This is pure laziness.
And I think this is one of the good things about having like this kind of discourse, is that I don't have any antagonistic thoughts about your critique or your opinion, because it's hard to defend this movie. All I can do is defend my stance on it. But there are people that you can't have that conversation with, because like, no, you're wrong. You know, there's a lot of cinema podcasts that are out there that if you're just going to listen to them argue for 30 minutes, well, I don't need to listen to a podcast for that. I can literally have that conversation with like anyone in my social group about movies that I love and they hate. So that's where this kind of discourse is becoming interesting, because like, I knew you're going to hate this movie. We never talk about the films before we record. I knew you're going to hate it. I knew this was not a Justin movie. And I think that you probably expected that I was going to have some weird opinion of it, which I do. And that's why I'm saying, like, where the subjectivity of cinematic discourse is really what makes a movie more entertaining, because you're going to make me think about things that I didn't think about this film. And I think that you're going to think about things that I've said about it. You're like, oh shit, am I going to watch this fucking movie again because Antonio brought something up? I mean, I'm going to watch this movie again because I fucking loved it. But that is the point. And when they have these conversations where they both agree, they do bring up a lot of similar points. Once we play the last sound bit, I want to read something from Roger's written review, which is a lot different than what he put on the show. So let's go ahead and listen to that before we finish that part up.
In a movie that is filled with disappointments, the biggest disappointment for me was the Bruce Willis character.
Absolutely.
They really missed a chance here. I mean, why do they get so tied up with the notion that they have to fill up a movie with stars that they don't look at the book and see who this drunken, British, freeloading little guy was? And why not get somebody who can play that fascinating character instead of having a big lump of dead space there taking up so much screen time?
The question I have is for Brian De Palma. If you want to make this film, why make it this way?
If you wanted to make it at all, try to make
it. There are a dozen directors that could have done a much better job.
That's kind of where it's at. Yes, there were other directors attached to this before De Palma took it. At the end of the day, I just have to read that book. We might have to have like a follow-up episode of like things that we learned about this film, because this film truly excited me and fascinated me more than any movie that we've covered on the podcast so far. Again, I'm not saying it's a good movie. I'm saying it just fascinated me that it exists and why it exists and how it exists. So I'm definitely going to do a lot more research and groundwork on that. But I agree with Roger 100% about the Bruce Willis character, but he's not the worst thing about this movie. Tom Hanks is the worst thing about this movie. Tom Hanks sucked. He was bad. And I'm not even sure if that's his fault. Maybe he just isn't very good at playing bad guys. It's just not him. It's not what we saw in the movies before, and it really isn't what we've seen in movies since. It's almost like The Rock having a contract where he can never lose in films, right? I feel like this is kind of the thing. Like, we have to be able to like Tom Hanks from screen, first moment he's on the screen till the end of the movie, till credits roll. And this is the one movie where he plays a guy that we really, really shouldn't like, but they do everything in their power to make us not hate him. And that was a mistake. He couldn't do it, and it wasn't directed right, and it wasn't written right. So to me, and normally I would say Melanie Griffith is like the, you know, most challenging thing of a movie for me, but for this one, it was Tom Hanks 100%.
100%. And there's nothing positive and nothing engaging than having a character, especially Tom Hanks, play it neutral. You can't have a main character play it neutral and be successful, especially when you have the persona of Tom Hanks that's always played kind of the good guy. And to Siskel and Ebert, I'm surprised they didn't bring this up in this review, because they were very critical of Tom Hanks during kind of this point in his career. So the fact that they focused on Bruce Willis, which in my opinion wasn't the worst character, I honestly, to give it some edge, I envisioned a Kelsey Grammer from 15 Minutes kind of character in this movie. But I think he had not the most screen time. If we're going to place blame on the ones that have to carry us through this story, not the one that just is placed to help move the story plot points when it needs to. So it fascinates me that they picked on Bruce Willis specifically.
Well, and then like the Melanie Griffith part, like I can understand why she's in the film, because she was in De Palma films before. You know, she was in Body Double, in which she plays a porn star, which, you know, she plays that well. But I don't buy the socialite aspect here, you know, and they try and kind of fix that with dialogue, you know. Oh, well, she's from the South and her husband's like this, you know, old rich philanthropist dude, and he knows that she's cheating on him with everybody. Okay, yeah, that probably has a lot to do with what the character represents in the book, but not once did I see her in this film as somebody that a guy would cheat on his wife with. It didn't make sense to me. And on that same note, to see a film where Kim Cattrall literally eats Tom Hanks for lunch, out-acts him, outperforms him, and steals every bit of energy on the screen when they share moments on the film together, I was like, you are killing this movie, Tom Hanks, if you're letting Kim Cattrall steal the scenes from you. It made me love her that much more in this movie. So, I mean, I could go in circles about this whole thing, but yes, Tom Hanks, sorry, buddy. But you know, he's not crying after the career he's had since the early 90s. So, again, I'm going to be somewhat predictably contradictory in my rating of Gene Siskel. Just because I liked the movie and he didn't, doesn't mean that I don't appreciate why he was disappointed and the verbiage that he used. You know, he read the book, he had very high expectations, but at the end of the day, he was severely disappointed, as most of America was, with this adaptation. So I think this is a solid C+ of a review for him. I think that he could have been a little bit more eloquent with his words and gone into a little bit more detail the way that Roger does of the why, right? And we talked about this before. He's so good at giving us the basic description of the movie's failures or why he wasn't entertained by it, but he doesn't do well with examples, you know? He doesn't do well with, okay, well, why did the character do this? And why did the director choose to do this? Instead, he likes to use action verbs. You know, he likes to say ugly. He likes to use the words like stupid, gory, dudger, you know, dangerous, things like that. And in this one, he uses the word namby-pamby, whatever. But it's not a bad critique of the film if you're coming at it from the viewpoint of a cinema critic, of a reviewer.
Yeah, and when it comes to Roger, here's kind of, it's a double-edged sword for me on this one, because given the time this review came out, the popularity of the book, I can see why his critique would kind of ease over to speaking more to the fan base than to the general audiences. But if I'm watching it today, that's what actually drove me a little bit nuts, as I kind of spoke to earlier, is it focuses too much on the fan base. And let's look at the characters by themselves. They don't mention Tom Hanks, Melanie Griffin, all these main characters that are supposed to drive this story, but he focuses on the one of the littler parts that, again, I wish we saw more of. So he doesn't add elements to really push that why factor for anybody to kind of take away from. So he is so upset with this adaption of what he wanted that he really doesn't give more of a reason cinematically of why this doesn't work, other than asking the question, why? Why would they make the movie this way? So if you can't fill in the blanks by watching this movie and give your actual insight to it, then to me, I don't think it's a complete critique. He goes in the depth on his written review, so I'm going to give him a little bit of credit on that. But again, the audio doesn't match the video when it comes to his written critique and what we see here. So for that reason, I'm going to give him kind of a neutral pass at 2 stars.
Okay, I like that. So the last paragraph of his written review kind of fascinates me, because it plays both sides. It plays your side and it plays my side. And that's where sometimes when I read his stuff, I'm like, oh, he almost liked it. I can tell he almost liked it. So he says, if The Bonfire of the Vanities lacks a texture and detail that would make it realistic, at least it does work well in a certain glossy way. Sharp satirical points are made, often as throwaways, and there are little moments of truth, as when Fallow takes Ruskin, Maria's husband, out to dinner. Like, there's that whole scene right before he dies where I get what he's saying. Like, it's the moment where we actually see the satire and the, I'm going to say, realistic synonyms that they're trying to do of that society of the time, of the elites, where he's like, oh yeah, I know my wife cheats on me. It's a really interesting moment. But then he pisses me off because he says, Kim Cattrall goes way over the top as Sherman's wife, Judy, which sometimes works, as when she tries to give a dinner party while her world crumbles around her. Great scene. However, he says, a famous scene from the book in which she explains to their child that daddy makes millions by taking crumbs from other people's cakes is overplayed and underlined until it dies. Fuck off. That was my favorite scene of the movie. That was the scene of the movie that where I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm locked. That was the moment where they literally reached out of the projection screen, grabbed me by the neck, and pulled me into the movie, and I was in. There's those moments in films where you're like, do I really want to finish this movie? Which I'm sure you had several, as you said. That was the moment that kept me in the movie, and he talks shit about it. Anyway, he finishes it off with, the beauty of The Wolf Book was the way that it saw through its time and place, dissecting motives and reading minds. The movie sees much, but it doesn't see through. That's a beautiful statement, because it pretty much wraps up what we're saying. It's showing us a lot from the book when it comes to the aesthetics, when it comes to like these fancy parties, stockbrokers, affairs, all that garbage, but it doesn't take us to that resolution of each character or what happens to these people once like the gig is up, right? It's an empty feeling kind of movie. And this is where I'm an idiot, because somehow I feel maybe that is a cruel joke and it's actually intentional, that there's an irony to it where it's like, you want to see these rich people get their comeuppance? Guess what? You don't get to, because that's what happens in real society like this, that they literally buy their way out of trouble, or they're so untouchable politically that they never see a jail cell, they never see any real ramifications to their actions. That's kind of what the whole movie is about. So in a way, that empty feeling that both he and Gene talk about this movie leaving for him, I'm going to play that weird kind of tinfoil hat guy and say, I think that might be intentional. It wants you to be disappointed in it, because we are disappointed when people at the upper crust of society don't get their comeuppance.
I will say I love your version 1,000 times better, but
it's probably not true, but that's how I like it.
You know, I love it. But at the end of the day, my take is it took for granted the fan base thinking the audience was going to fill in the blanks because this book was so popular. Yeah, they got overconfident, and that's the fault of the writing, in my opinion. But I love the articulate finisher of the Roger Ebert review. But obviously, Ebert had his favorite characters in this book, and he made it apparent because he hated your favorite and he hated my favorite. So there's no winning in Roger's review in our cases.
Well, of course, the two film critics are going to like the smarmy journalist. Why wouldn't they? It speaks to their inner person. Anyway, well, I love this conversation, and it's cool that you hated this movie. I loved this movie for probably all the wrong reasons, and I'm totally comfortable with that. And I'm going to buy it. It's a shelf-worthy movie for me. And I'm going to examine it. I'm going to buy that stupid book probably today, you know, or find it on Audible or something. I want it. I want to know more about this. I haven't been so excited about the background of a film since Alien 3. Like, what happened? Directors changed? Stories changed? I need to hear all about it. So this is like my Alien 3 of tinfoil hat. Let's dive in.
Tell you what, you buy the book, I'm buying the book, so we'll circle back.
Right, seriously, this could be like the first time we do a follow-up episode to a film, especially a film with such a low score and a low rating. So anyway, maybe we'll fare better next week, because next week we are going to bring Justin's pick to the show, which is the Michael J. Fox film, The Secret to My Success. Such a Justin pick. That's going to be a fun conversation. I can't wait to rewatch it. Yeah.
It's been a while. I can't wait for that one. Classic.
So anyway, thank you for putting up with us this episode. Thank you for putting up with this film. I'm curious to know what people think about this. So please get on YouTube. We're getting a lot of YouTube comments lately. There's a lot of fun discussion happening in the chats and the comment sections of the last episode, especially. So let us know what your thoughts of Bonfire the Vanities are. We'll probably end up reading them on a follow-up episode so we can see, what does the public think? Are they rediscovering this film? It literally is like the one De Palma film that nobody talks about. I mean, all over cinema podcasting right now in the Twitterverse, everyone's talking about Blowout and Carrie. Snake Eyes has like a reemergence right now. No one's talking about Bonfire of the Vanities, so let's get that conversation going.
Rightfully so.
Rightfully so. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You can find me, Antonio, at The Cultworthy at thecultworthy.com. You can find my co-host, Justin, at
themoviewire.com.
And like we always say, if there's a film that you want to have us cover, as long as Siskel and Ebert reviewed it, let us know and we'll throw it on our list. Justin, I will see you next week.
See you next week.